Hey there, web or podcast listeners. I'm Vermont Edition producer Matthew Smith, and I wanted to let you know that this podcast has been edited to make it a little bit shorter and a little bit sweeter. Thanks, and I hope you enjoy.
This is Vermont Edition. I'm Bob Kinzel. For years, backers of a plan to have primary enforcement of Vermont seatbelt law have been unsuccessful at the State House, but have times changed? This morning, the House gave its final approval to a highway safety measure that includes primary enforcement and several other important measures. What accounts for the change in attitude in the legislature about this issue? House Transportation Chairman Pat Brennan explains why he changed his mind on this issue.
We had a series of unbelted deaths this summer, so you take a serious look when you get news like that, and it turns out to be turns into a trend, basically, and I had concerns with that.
Will having a primary enforcement law increase the seatbelt compliance rate in Vermont? And what are some of the other key provisions in this highway safety bill? These are some of the issues we're going to look at with our guest today, Colchester Representative Pat Brennan, who is the chairman of the House Transportation Committee. Also with us, Jennifer Morrison, who is the chief of police in Colchester, also the president of the Vermont Police Chiefs Association. Great to have you here.
Great to be here, Bob. Thanks.
Representative Brennan, the highway safety bill passed this morning 133-7. And we should mention to our listeners that right now we have secondary enforcement of the seatbelt law, which means that a driver has to be picked up for a different reason in order to be charged with a seatbelt violation. And this would give law enforcement officers the opportunity to stop someone if they see a violation of the seatbelt law. Yesterday on the House floor, you told a story about a guy who really didn't think it was the role of government to tell people what to do when it came to seatbelts. And this person thought it was very inconvenient to wear a seatbelt, and so they didn't use a seatbelt very often. Well, as you mentioned, that person turned out to be you.
Correct.
What changed your mind on this issue?
Well, Bob, you know, in the position that I'm in the committee I serve on, we deal with law enforcement, we deal with traffic issues, the Agency of Transportation, public safety, highway safety. And through the years, the trend of seatbelt use has become stagnant, if not slipping a little. And, you know, hearing about the series of unbelted deaths this summer, you know, kind of opens your eyes a little bit, so enough to where you want to have a discussion. And through that discussion, not only myself, but the committee as a whole, and I might add it was a 10-0 vote out of committee to support this piece of the highway safety bill, just decided it was time to do something.
Do you think that the attitude of folks in Vermont as well as in the legislature have changed on this issue maybe over the last 10 years?
Yeah, I think it has. I think with the, like I said, the series of deaths, and it's not just this year, it's an ongoing thing. 52% of fatals in Vermont are unbelted. And the opportunity for us to save a few lives each year and gain in percentage of use, we chose to seize that opportunity, and that's why you have the bill before you.
Chief Morrison, primary enforcement, good idea?
Oh, yeah, it's a great idea, and it's really fantastic to see some straightforward common sense legislation coming at us in the law enforcement field out of Montpelier. We're really encouraged by this, and, you know, I think it's not only do the statistics bear it out that we will have fewer fatalities, but when you also consider in the last couple decades the safety advancements that the manufacturers of motor vehicles have made, they have been absolutely amazing, the changes in passenger safety, but they only work if you use them. So basically we are insisting that the motoring public use the tools that the manufacturers have provided to keep them safe, but also to keep them in a position behind the wheel. Many people who are unbelted in a crash, not only would they possibly have survived, but they might have been able to keep better control of their vehicle if they were not thrown from behind the wheel. So there's multiple advantages to this, but we think this is a great, great news out of Montpelier.
Has it been frustrating for law enforcement officials not to be able to stop somebody when you see that they're not wearing a seatbelt and there's nothing you can do about it?
Yeah, we've definitely heard that expressed for years, that they really would like the opportunity to stop the person, even just to educate them at roadside. However, the authority has not been there for us to, you know, use our authority to stop and have a chat.
Representative Brennan, we got a couple of emails on this subject, a few from folks who don't like this idea. We got this from Steve in Springfield. I don't understand why we keep trying to legislate common sense. Everybody knows they should wear their seatbelts, so if they don't, too bad. I know it's hard on families who lose loved ones, but we need to take personal responsibility for our actions, or in this case, a lack of action. And we got this from Nathan very much the same way. I got pulled over and received a $150 ticket for not using my seatbelt in another state as a group of motorcyclists went by without helmets. If I choose not to wear a seatbelt, it doesn't concern anyone but me, and it doesn't endanger anyone but me.
Well, Bob, here's what I would say to that. That's a misconception. The whole premise about wearing a seatbelt and just protecting yourself is a misnomer. It's not just about you. It's about the rest of the traveling public. It's about loved ones, as one person said there. But it's also about the people you affect outside of the car, the medical bills that are accrued, and the onus put on the public for all these expenses. You know, you don't just affect yourself while you're driving the car unbelted. It's the public around you we have to look out for also.
Let's start off with our callers and talk to Michael in St. Johnsbury. Hi, Michael. Welcome to the program.
Hi. I just want to say, you know, from a personal anecdote perspective, about 20-some-odd years ago, my father was in an accident. He was T-boned. If he'd been wearing a seatbelt, he would have been killed instantly. Because he didn't have a seatbelt on, he lived for another 15 years or so. You know, our legislators are no more enlightened than we are, and if this is the kind of stuff that's going to come out of Montpelier, we citizens really need a ballot referendum to our Constitution to counter this. You know, we have a constitutional convention in our federal Constitution that we can invoke if the capital S state becomes too oppressive. And, you know, we need a state version of that, too. And that's what the ballot referendums are.
Okay. Michael, we appreciate your phone call. Representative Brennan, are there circumstances where wearing a seatbelt is a more dangerous situation?
I wouldn't say that. I think there are situations where a seatbelt may not have saved a person. That's a given. On a really horrific, serious crash, you know, you could look at it and say a seatbelt wouldn't have saved them. I think the instances where a seatbelt will save someone and reduce the risk of flying out of the car, being ejected, is a lot better.
I think for every one of those stories that we hear, the answer is the same. Is it possible what the caller said is actually true when you get down to the physics of it? Sure, it's possible. But we will never know because it's not a situation that happened. Do you see what I'm saying? We don't know. We can't quantify what would have happened. These are all speculation and guesses. But for every one of these stories that we hear 20 times as many stories about how a seatbelt did save a life. So the other thing I'd like to point out is I'm pretty sure the caller said that this happened 20 or 25 years ago. And the safety measures that I spoke of earlier in the manufacturing of automobiles has changed so much since then that what was true then, if it was true then, it may not be true now.
Let's talk to Don, who's calling from Brownington. Hi, Don. Welcome to the program.
Hello.
Hi there. What's on your mind, Don?
They keep using the phrase or unbelted highway fatalities. I'm curious if they have a breakdown as to how many of these unbelted fatalities were on motorcycles or on bicycles or pedestrians, which none of those you would be wearing a seatbelt anyway. And I need to tell you that I am very much against this. I feel it is another way for the state to grab more of our personal liberties and the money grab, because now they're going to be ticketing everybody for not wearing a seatbelt, which I think is a totally ridiculous idea.
Okay, Don, thanks for your phone call. Representative Brennan?
Well, first of all, the fine for primary seatbelt offense wouldn't change from what it is now in a secondary offense, which is $25 for first offense, and which is a pretty minor fine for what you get to do at roadside for education purposes. So second of all, I would say some of those unbelted deaths, I can tell you that one was a motorcycle, okay? And I don't think that's in the number of unbelted deaths. Unbelted deaths is strictly the statistics for someone that isn't belted in the car.
Let's go back to our callers and talk to Brian in Burlington. Hey, Brian, what's on your mind today?
Hey, how's it going?
Good.
This is what I say. I'm all about, you know, road safety and things like that. I've lived through this legislation in other states, and I found it to be a kind of an open season to pull anybody over that you wanted to. And, you know, once you have somebody on the side of the road, you can pretty much find anything you want to detain them for. And that was just concerning to me. But thank you.
All right. Chief, what about what we're hearing from some of the callers and some of the emails that we got? They see this as the heavy hand of government, and they don't trust government. They think, you know, that there are going to be circumstances that law enforcement are going to pull people over and give them a ticket because they want to, or there could be any number of reasons why they're doing it. How do you respond to that?
Well, I think the way that policing as a profession needs to respond to it is through transparency and accountability to the public. You know, the circumstance in which we policed 25, 30 years ago is not the environment within which we're policing now. We certainly have more cameras documenting every move we make and every conversation we have. We certainly collect more data and make that data available to the public. You know, I'm sympathetic to the concern that this is the heavy hand of government. None of us, police officers included, want to feel that way. I think at the end of the day, the sentiment that you're expressing, Bob, is about public trust. And either the community has trust and faith in their local police, their state police, their county police, or they don't. And those are much more systemic issues and root cause problems that have to be ferreted out. At the end of the day, police officers have neither the time nor the inclination to randomly pull people over for made-up offenses. It doesn't happen. We are, in fact, in Colchester, and the only other place I have firsthand experience is in Burlington, is we find it to be a luxury when we have time to go out and run focused traffic safety details, because frequently we are only having an opportunity between other calls for service to do traffic safety activities. So the myth of us using this as an opportunity to pull over every car just because we want to is one that is only going to be dispelled through public trust, open communication, and accountability and transparency.
Let's talk to John in Windsor. Hey, John, welcome to the program.
Thank you very much. I wear a seatbelt, and I have worn them. I'm retired now, but I've worn them all my life. And I wore them before Big Brother told me I had to. Now, for years, Vermont was trying to pass a seatbelt law, and they couldn't pass it. And finally, the law was that it would be, you couldn't pull over for a seatbelt, but if you committed some kind of offense and they pulled you over and you didn't have it, then they could fine you. But now that they snuck in the back door, now they want it full time. So what's next? Now, I live on the banks of the Connecticut River in Vermont. I've always lived in Vermont, but I go in New Hampshire all the time. They have zero seatbelt law. And the federal government says, when seatbelts were coming in, they said, any state who does not have a seatbelt law does not receive federal funding. Well, New Hampshire kind of thumbed their nose at that, and they got this funding anyway. But I think it is very smart to wear a seatbelt. But Big Brother keeps changing the laws and the rules just to pass the law, and then it's open season. So I'm a little bit upset about that.
Okay, John, we appreciate your phone call very much. Let's turn to David in Mount Tabor. Hey, David,
Hello?
Welcome to the program.
Hello.
Hi.
Hi. I'm one of the people who's happened upon somebody who was flung out of her vehicle when it rolled over, and she would have lived otherwise. I had to kneel there on a rocky road waiting for stabilizing her head while the EMTs argued about where to park while she died. I don't want to do that all the time if I'm on a road and some idiot isn't wearing their seatbelt. I also don't want to have to pay more for the state to support the emergency room for morons who are hurt more than they need to be.
All right, David, thanks for your phone call. Representative Brennan, that was one of the points you made early in the program, that if it was just affecting the driver or the passenger, that would be one thing. But there are implications for other drivers on the road as well.
Correct. And the caller, I think, made my case for me. It's very important to realize it's just not about the driver. It's not about your personal choice. It behooves you to be concerned about the rest of the traveling public and the people that it affects around you. You know, an officer, the first officer on the scene, we heard some testimony from first responders and what it's like when you have to make that phone call to family and stuff and let them know that, you know, their loved ones were tossed out of the car and laying became a fatality on the side of the road. So there's a lot to it.
This is Vermont Edition. I'm Bob Kinzel. Today in the program, we're looking at a highway safety bill that's just been passed by the House today. With us, Jennifer Morrison, who is chief of police in Colchester, also the president of the Vermont Police Chiefs Association, and Colchester Representative Pat Brennan, who is chairman of the House Transportation Committee. Let's talk to Kevin in Burlington. Hi, Kevin. Welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me. So I had a quick question and statement. I read about a lawsuit, I think it was like 6-7 months ago, about this kind of situation coming up in which the actual evidence brought to the court was that police weren't able to reliably verify that people were wearing seatbelts at 25 feet from the street at 25 miles an hour and beyond. I was wondering if anything had been looked into when this law was getting passed on that premise.
I'm not familiar with the case law that the caller is referring to, but I can tell you that with 27 plus years experience, it is very easy to tell if somebody is wearing a seatbelt, particularly if you are passing them on a roadway, approaching from an intersecting roadway. The only way you wouldn't be able to tell consistently is if you're behind them, but even then you can see the seatbelt extending from the wall anchor towards the steering wheel area, which is what the view would look like from behind. So, you know, based on my training and experience, I would dispute that that statement is true. But again, I'm not familiar with the case law that the caller is referring to.
Let's take a look at some of the other provisions of this law, Representative Brennan. It establishes some additional penalties for junior drivers who use portable electronic devices, iPhones, iPads, iPods. Why did you target this group of drivers?
Well, it wasn't just this group of drivers, Bob. It was it's an ongoing issue with everyone these days, and I call it an epidemic. But in this case, you know, I think statistics may say that drivers under 21, and they are still junior operators. Actually, it's 18 and under, not 21 and under. They are still junior operators, learning the ropes, learning the rules of the road. So we felt it was important that they abide by like a zero tolerance for texting, zero tolerance for handheld devices. And so that's where the penalties came. But there was also a piece of that puzzle that ties into federal law. There is a NHTSA highway safety grant out there floating around to the tune of about $130,000 that by complying with how the feds do, you know, enforce this legislation, we would be eligible for that. But it's more about being consistent and holding a junior operator to the rules of the road.
And, you know, to some degree, Bob, we're having to retrain a whole generation about what does it mean to be the operator of a motor vehicle, because there's so much technology available to us that there wasn't before. So this emphasis on junior operators really is about behavior modification and education in the youngest age group of drivers, hoping that that carries forward and eventually over time we have the entire driving population complying with that, and that's just the way it is for them, as opposed to what we're dealing with right now. As the representative said, it's an epidemic of people completely infatuated with their electronic devices and never being able to look away or put them down.
Representative Brennan, do you need to do something about that epidemic? I remember seeing a report recently that said that Vermont was the worst state in the country for people who use handheld cell phones and or texting. Has the legislature done enough to discourage that use?
I would say no. It's a tough sell. This is a very small step in that direction. But no, we haven't done enough. And it's not falling on deaf ears. I actually have a bill coming my way called a DUIE. And there's one other state in the country that does this. It's called Driving Under the Influence of Electronics. And, you know, I don't know if it's going to get any play or not. But so people are concerned. This came from someone from the southern part of Vermont. And we'll take a look at it as we do with all bills. But the awareness is out there. We just have to figure out the path we're going to take.
Let's talk to Eric, who's calling from Burke. Hi, Eric. Welcome to the program.
Hi. Speaking of epidemics, I totally agree on the texting thing. But there's this epidemic of speeding as well. Get on I-91, set your speedometer to 68 and drive down to Brattleboro. you'd be lucky if you pass anybody. And, you know, a lot of those people who are passing you by at 80 or 85 or on their cell phone or whatever, some of them probably don't have their seatbelt on either. But I think driving without your seatbelt in that respect is probably safer than going. How much, what's the stats on highway deaths from people who are speeding? So.
Eric, that's a great question. Chief, is it my imagination or in the last 5 or 10 years, have people decided to drive faster on the interstate?
I do believe that that's true. I mean, we don't spend much time patrolling the interstate system, but certainly we are experiencing that on our state routes and even on our local routes. I think that there is a greater comforture level with the modern vehicle than there was perhaps 20 or 25 years ago, where people either don't perceive or are not aware that they're speeding as much. I think that people really are speeding. I concur with what the caller has said. And there is an epidemic. And really, it speaks to a lack of personal accountability. And yes, we need to have more enforcement efforts directed in towards highway safety generally, whether that's speeding, distracted driving, and now occupant protection. So I agree with them wholeheartedly. And I don't – the only answer that I've ever been able to come up with about why are people speeding more is twofold. One is the technology's better. The cars are smoother. You really can go faster without the perception that you're going faster. And secondly, we are living in a hyper-connected world, and everybody perceives that they have to be – to the next place super fast. Everything has to be done on the fly, super fast. And that those are the only two explanations that make sense to me about why we have more people speeding.
Yeah, you mentioned the change in the design of cars. They're safer now than they were 5, 10, 20 years ago. But a lot of new cars now also have touch screens on them, right? Asking the driver to interact in any number of ways. It could be involving their phone. It could be navigation. It could be changing different settings in the car. How much of a problem do you think that is for distracted driving?
You know, I think that's a tough one to measure. But I have real concerns about vehicles that are super technologically advanced, and then you put a generation like myself, the baby boomers and the older baby boomers who are getting behind the wheel, who are not technologically savvy or quick, and that becomes a greater distraction to them trying to negotiate and figure out all these things than the basics, because they grew up with the basics. I'm not sure if it's able to be measured, but I'm pretty confident that the younger generation is going to do better with those highly automated vehicles. Most of the manufacturers have tried to find that balance between amenities and safety. For instance, you can't program in where you're trying to go with your navigation unless you're in park, and a variety of other safety measures like that. So it's a completely valid point. I'm not sure how you measure the results of it, but it's the reality we live in now.
Let's talk to Larry, who's calling from Burlington. Hi, Larry. Welcome to the program.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. First, I'm pleased that the legislature is moving in the direction that is driven by the evidence. It is a little disappointing to me that this seems only possible when they're sort of emotionally moved by anecdote and local things, because while it's terrible that we had such a bad summer in Vermont, it's the facts have been there for a while. And but what I really want to get to, and is related to what Chief Morrison just talked about, is the fact that the evidence is very clear that hands-free cell phone use is no more, if not more, dangerous than using a handset. I teach research methods at UVM, and it dismayed me to see the legislature sort of stick to their guns on this, because they want to, you know, apparently they want to be able to drive while talking on their cell phones, and just because making it hands-free makes it convenient, it doesn't make it safer. In fact, the laboratory evidence shows that it's slightly less safe. And so I really hope that going forward, these decisions are driven by the evidence.
Okay, Larry, thanks for your phone call. Chief, you know, some people who are listening are going to say, what's the difference between being on your cell phone, as Larry mentioned, hands-free or hands-on, and talking to the passenger and having a heated discussion with someone in the front seat of the car? Do you see them as being different situations?
You know, I think it all comes down to divided attention. And, you know, Larry makes a great point around evidence-based decision-making in when we talk about legislation, when we talk about enforcement or where to spend our resources. And I do appreciate him introducing that to the conversation. But ultimately, at the end of the day, what we're talking about is divided attention. And can you really be truly attentive enough to operate a motor vehicle safely, given the complex environment inside the vehicle that we were just talking about, and all the potential things that are happening on the road in front of you? And the answer is no. Now, I don't think I'm qualified to say, is an argument with your passenger equivalent to an intense conversation on a hands-free system? I don't think I can answer that. They are both a distraction, and one of them theoretically involves somebody who's right at your elbow and could potentially be, you know, a more intense conversation than somebody who you're on the phone with. But I think the rationale behind the hands-free is that it takes one piece out of the divided attention, which is managing the device physically with one of your hands that should be on the road. And it also takes out the piece of looking down at the device and taking your eyes off the highway. So if he's aware of evidence and laboratory outcomes that show that it makes it worse, I would be very interested in hearing that. But I understand the rationale behind why the legislation is the way it is, and it makes sense at face value. But I'm all about seeing what the evidence brings and what the tests show to make sure that we have folks operating in the safest environment possible.
Let's talk to John, who's calling from Wilmington. Hi, John. Welcome to the program.
Thank you. Yeah, I think I first started listening when you were just talking about seatbelts and other things have been added to, like, the distracted driving and stuff. And I would say when I was in the military, I remember one base I was at, when you'd pull out to go to a regular highway off the base, they had a big sign that said, "You are now entering the most dangerous area of the United States, a public highway." And that's true. And I would like to – how many people can even make it through a year without somebody pulling out – in front of them, and they have to hit the brakes or something or other. And now we've got people that are on cell phones, et cetera, et cetera. And there's so many things out there. Every time a car comes towards you, you don't know if they're on drugs, you don't know if they're talking on a cell phone, whatever, they may be a brand new driver. Extremely potentially dangerous. Now, when you look at the number of people who are killed, but a lot of people just take so much for granted and all. But I had a situation where I had a friend that wouldn't wear the seatbelt in the passenger seat. And just after I got through convincing him, someone backed out of a driveway here a couple of years ago, and I had hit the brakes. And if she didn't have it on, her head would have bounced off the window. So it's kind of amazing. I don't know if it's ignorance or what, but seatbelts are extremely important, not to mention everything else. So.
John, thank you very much for your phone call. Representative Brennan, there's also a provision in the bill that adds new penalties for drivers who are under the influence of alcohol or drugs when a minor is in the car. Is this a growing problem in Vermont?
It seems to be, and I don't have statistics to prove that, but, you know, if you watch the news, listen to the news reports out there, you'll hear once or twice every summer there's a person with the precious cargo in the car, and they are pulled over at sometimes one, two times the limit, over the BAC limit. So I think it's an ongoing problem, and apparently the Governor's Highway Safety Council does also. And that's why we have this language in here that creates an additional penalty for anyone caught with minors in the car under the influence.
You mentioned on the House floor yesterday that Vermont doesn't rank very well among all the states when it comes to highway safety. Is that primarily because of the secondary enforcement of the seatbelt law, or are there other factors as well?
I think that has a lot to do with it. Again, I can't pinpoint any one area, but primary seatbelt offense will move us up at least to the middle of the pack, I'm hopeful. And it's like I said earlier, it's going to be a interesting watch for us on the committee, but I expect seatbelt usage to go up to around 90 to 92% in Vermont as a result of this.
Let's talk to Lenny in St. Johnsbury. Hi, Lenny. Welcome to the program.
Hello. Thank you for the program. My question, I guess, is specifically directed or best directed to Representative Brennan. You know, today's discussion has been about, you know, legislative involvement, where safety is, you know, there's clearly a case to be made for safety, you know, being achieved. I'm wondering if the Transportation Committee is looking at relaxing the vehicle inspection standards, which, you know, purport to target safety, but where there really, in a lot of cases, is no reasonable case to be made for safety. And there was just an editorial in Vermont Digger, which generated a lot of reaction to it, you know, about this topic, where the state really does seem to be overreaching, going to be a major affordability issue for low-income Vermonters with the way the inspection system is being run and what is not passing in vehicles. So, and I can take my answer off the air. Thank you.
Okay, Lenny, thanks for your phone call. Representative Brennan, there's been some conversations about this.
Yes, there have, Bob. And Lenny, thanks for the question. It gives me an opportunity to tell you and the public what we're doing at this time. We have a committee looking at and rewriting the whole inspection. There are two of them, actually, safety manuals, to see exactly what pertains to safety, what pertains to A&R requirements, clean air and stuff. So there are a lot of issues with that. The book hasn't changed. I might mention that. The inspection manual is the same as it always was. However, the inspection stations have their feet held to the fire a little closer with the computerized results printout from that. So we do have a committee, and the report is due shortly. They will be removing some things. I don't believe we're adding anything. I think we're looking at strictly safety measures and what we can do with and can't do without.
So was the law passed or the procedures passed so that individuals can't go sort of garage shopping to get their car inspected?
Exactly. That was the crux of the matter, and I think we've accomplished that. And it's all about keeping our roads safer.
You know, a lot about what we've talked about today, Bob, really comes down to a common theme that I've watched in my time in policing, which is a total degradation of common civility. There's just no sense of courtesy on the road of looking out for the other guy. And it really has become a me-first generation, not generation, but the population has become very me-first. And I have to say that we really need to go back to the basics of common civility and looking out for each other.
Is there more incidents of road rage out there?
I don't have any statistics to bear it out, but I think that we certainly hear more anecdotal stories. Not road rage might be a little bit over the top, but road discourtesy, road menacing. Again, this is not just on our roadways. It's in our communities. It is a ripping of the social fabric that makes communities strong. And it's really something we have to start talking about as communities, is how do we keep our community strong, healthy, resilient, and look out for each other in a way that's appropriate?
We'll certainly be following the highway safety bill as it moves over to the Senate. Many thanks to our guest today for this discussion, Colchester Police Chief Jennifer Morrison, and also Pat Brennan, who is the chairman of the House Transportation Committee. Thank you both very much.
Thank you, Bob.
Thanks, Bob.